Okay, so British art since 1945. Now, I'm not an expert on art, but I try to keep up. Looking at British art since 1945 opens up a number of questions. And one of the questions is, does it exist? That is to say, if you look at the most famous artists of since 1945, Picasso, Kokoschka, do they belong anymore to a particular nation? Or is art now so international that there's no real meaning to talk about British arts? We will be comparing this later with other ideas. For example, cinema. Is there a British cinema? Is there British rock music? Or is all of this just so international that you can't look at it anymore? Now, probably I would think that for the question of art, the question is the most open. That is that the international influences are very, very big influences between artists internationally. It's very easy for artists to see American artists and Russian artists and be influenced. And so it's an open question of whether you really have a British tradition in art. But I will be showing you some of the British artists who have been popular or unpopular and trying to link that in with some British social history. But first of all, an extremely rapid look at modern art in general. Extremely rapid look. And modern art, in my opinion, begins with the invention of the camera. Because once you can take a perfect picture of these two people, you no longer need the artist to do a perfect picture. We have a camera for that. And so little by little, artists are not interested anymore in showing exactly what you see. The camera takes over this space of showing exactly what you see. And artists will not want to do that anymore. And the first big group of artists who don't want to do that anymore is the French, the Impressionists. And their fundamental idea, summarized in three sentences, is what is important is how the light works, the effects of the light. Can you get onto canvas the exact light at a particular time, at a particular day? And this is why, of course, they have their favorite places to work on the south coast in France, or sometimes in Brittany, sometimes in Holland, to get places where the light is special. And the concentration is on, can you get the light exactly how it is, the physical side of it? Don't worry about what it is. Don't worry, oh, this is a cathedral and this is a cow. That's not the problem. The problem is trying to transport exactly the light. This is Impressionism. And it will be very influential and will move us away from the idea that it must be exactly what it's like. I don't know if you ever heard the quotation from Stalin, who was very angry at, I can't remember, somebody's paintings, and he said, cows are not green. Because some modern painter painted a painting with cows which were green. And Stalin's position was, cows are not green, so you shouldn't paint them green. This is against the idea of modern art. The idea of modern art is you have a lot of choice. And the first choice is you can try to present on paper exactly what happened with the lights. But that's not the only choice. This is Picasso. From the very beginning of the 20th century, 1908, 1910, something like that, around before the First World War. Yeah, have you got an exact date on that? Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. And again, the idea is we are no longer interested in exactly what they look like. We're interested in playing around with symbols and meanings. Here you have an African mask as part of the naked woman in Avignon. And you have the composition of breaking the object apart and putting it back together, a vaguely cubist in conception. But again, the idea is you are no longer tied to painting what you see. This will go much further with Munch and many, many other painters. This is just one example. And this is the idea that what you paint comes from your emotions. This is expressionism. What is important, you can see that both this one and the Monet are not what you really see, but they are different in that Monet is trying to find the effects of the light, an objective phenomenon, And the expressionists are saying, no, make the painting look like what your emotions come from. So obviously she's screaming and the landscape is screaming too. It's one of the things you can do with art is expressionism, to express yourself with art. This is very much part of the modern era. But this is a little bit later. But that's not the end of the story, because you also have the rise of abstract art, where you say, if we have cameras to take pictures, there are many other things we can do with painting, and it doesn't have to be about our emotions. This is not a very emotional picture. This is Mondrian, rather a special sort of abstract painting, and his idea was that the universe is made up of infinite lines, and this is just one little slice. You have to imagine them all continuing forever in every direction. So it's another thing which artists have wanted to do in the 20th and 21st century, and that is to play with forms, very playful. Play is important. To play with forms and also to play with materials. A lot of artists play with materials. So they will take something and use a very heavy material, but they will make it look very light. Or the opposite. Take a very light material and make it look very heavy. So it's ways of representing the world, but not just as you see it, but lots of ways of representing the world plus emotion, or representing the world plus distortion. One last example before I go to Britain, American artist Jackson Pollock, who developed this particular form of painting. He did many like this, called action painting, where he doesn't use a brush or anything. He throws the paint and drips the paint on the canvas, enormous canvases. And one of the ideas behind this is the idea that the painting is a record of a gesture. So you take some paint and you do that, and what you have here is a record of this gesture, like the record of a dance. Now, the first thing that people do, as we can see, the first thing people do when they look at paintings is they try to think, do I like it or don't I like it? So I want you to not do that for today, because what I want to do is try to understand why people did a particular piece of work and why somebody liked it, even if it's not you. Okay, it's not always easy, yes, because you sometimes get the another reaction. You say, well, I could do that. Yes?
But don't we need the explanation of the author?
Another question, does the author know, can the author explain their art? Not necessarily, it's controversial. A lot of painters say, no, I'm not explaining, look at the painting. Very often we have the idea that the art is about the audience reaction, so you can choose. You can choose what you see in it. So sometimes the painter will tell you something about it, but the other idea is that the painter doesn't always know what they put in it. Yeah. And certainly in literature we see this. If you look at the detail of Hamlet, Shakespeare did not know he was putting all that in. It just felt right, and because he's an artist, it comes out in a great, in a wonderful complexity, the conscious and the unconscious and so on. But the history of British arts in 1945 is not just the history of painters. It's also the history of an amazing rise in the popularity of modern art. 50 years ago, modern art was really not very popular among ordinary people, and this has absolutely transformed, and you can see this. One more example before I go onto that. Two more examples before I go on to it. We're not in Britain yet. This is a piece by Christo. Do you recognize the building? The building? Yeah, it's in Berlin. It's the Reichstag. It's a major historical palace, which is now the German Parliament. And what he has done, he has wrapped it up. This is his particular form. He wraps things up. Emballage du Reichstag. So what is he doing here? Well, really, it's very much about thinking. What is the Reichstag? The Reichstag is an old, traditional, massive, institutional building full of history. What do you normally wrap up? Little things, mobile things, things you can give away, presents. And so you have this contrast between something which is, you know, just really solid and historic, and a form which is extremely unusual. This is the wrapped Reichstag. He also wrapped the Pont Neuf in Paris back in the 1970s. So wrapping, it was his thing. And so there you get something which is really, in a way, what we call conceptual art. That is to say that what is important is not the object, it's the idea. Yeah. It's true that anybody with enough money can wrap a Reichstag, but only Christo had the idea, which is a very strange idea, it has to be said. On the same lines of conceptual art, you have artists like Ben, who is simply going to give you a black board written Espion de l'art dessus, and that's all you get. And so what you're getting is a thought, or maybe a joke, or both. So that's the kind of the international setting. That was the 5-minute version of what's happening in modern art in general. But I was saying that in Britain, what's important is also how popular it has become. And the Tate Gallery is the main modern art museum in Britain. It belongs to the government. It was founded in 1897 as the National Gallery of British Arts. But slowly it has been transformed and it's separated into two. Now in London it's separated into two. There is Tate Britain and Tate Modern. And the modern one is the one we're going to look at. There are two other Tate galleries in Britain in two other towns, Liverpool and St. Ives, which is down in Cornwall. All of these museums are free to the public. There is a tradition in Britain of museums being free. For a short time in the 1980s, the government said, no, people must pay to get to museums, but it was very unpopular, and they're now free again, which is very good news for poor students like you. Today, the Tate Gallery has four museums, Tate Britain, Tate Modern in London, Tate Liverpool, and Tate St. Ives. Here is Tate Modern. No, that's the Tate Gallery. That's now Tate Britain. That's now Tate Britain. And this is Tate Modern. It was opened in 2000. Tate Modern was opened in 2000. It was... There are two things about it. First of all, it was a power station. C'est une centrale électrique. So it joins the tradition of making museums out of other things, like the Musée d'Orsay. In the first year it was open, it was the most popular museum in the world with 5 million visitors. For the first year, it even passed in front of the Louvre for 1 year. And so it certainly appears to be the case that modern art today is no longer just about the elite, it's also about people in general. Tate Liverpool, founded in 1888. Tate St. Ives, the latest one. They're founded in 1993. Tate St. Ives, founded in 1993. St. Ives is a town in Cornwall which had a collection of painters who worked there. And there was the Tate website for you to explore around that. Okay, so we can see that modern art has become more and more popular in Britain and in other countries, but we're talking about Britain. Let's have a look now at some other projects and artists who have been important in the last 50 years in Britain. First of all, I want to look at a project, which is the project of the fourth plinth. What is a plinth? C'est un socle, c'est le quatrième socle. If you go to London in Trafalgar Square, you will see there are four lions, and there are also four big plinths, the socle. Three of them have big statues on them, kings on horses, you know, the standard sort of thing, and one of them is empty. That's the situation. As you know, in the center of the square is Nelson's Column, with Admiral Nelson at the top, a symbol of the defense of the British Empire. The southern plinths have people on horses. In the northeast, you have the George IV on a horse. And the fourth plinth was supposed to carry a statue of William IV when they built it in 1841, but they didn't have enough money, so they left it empty. And they left it empty for 150 years. And somebody then decided, well, this would be a good place to have contemporary art, to have modern art on there. Why is it a good place to have modern art? Well, first of all, this is Trafalgar Square. It is the most symbolic place in London. It's the centre. Trafalgar, yeah, a naval battle, which the British were victorious. It's a centre of national pride and tradition. And so having a modern art there is a kind of a little game. Since 1998, there has been a succession of works commissioned from contemporary artists, from artists living today, some of whom we will see. For example, this one is by Bill. There's the empty fourth plinth with nothing on it. Isn't that exciting? And here is one example of a work by Bill Woodrow, which appears to be a tree growing out of a big book, a big historical book. It's called Regardless of History, so the title is not an accident. Yeah, here we are in an extremely historical place. Yeah, Nelson, George IV, and here you have Regardless of History, and overflowing tree climbing out of there. I will show you some more. I think this was there for 6 months. Every 6 months they change what they put up there. So it's kind of a nice idea that it changes. You can go to Trafalgar Square and see what's on at the moment. There is still a big debate on what should be done. In 2003, a big campaign was launched to try to find enough money to put a statue of Nelson Mandela on this plinth. Why Nelson Mandela? Well, first of all, it's opposite the South African embassy. Okay, but also, it would be an interesting contrast. You have Nelson, the British Empire, and George IV, you know, the grandeur of Britain, whereas Nelson Mandela represents more liberation from colonization. So it would be an interesting contrast. It was not done. They put the statue somewhere else. 3 years ago, somebody proposed to have one of the commanders of the Royal Air Force during the Battle of Britain put up there. So much more traditional idea. Yes, a patriotic leader of the Air Force during the Second World War. Yes, which would fit perhaps with less contrast to Nelson. So this debate is going on. One of the more interesting things was, I think, One and Other. And One and Other was a type of contemporary art by Anthony Gormley, and it continued from July to October. It lasted 100 days. And what he did is he put out on the internet an appeal, and he says, who would like to spend 1 hour on the plinth doing whatever they want? And he received thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of replies, and he chose 2,400 replies, and for 24 hours, for 100 days, 2,400 people did different things. Up there, and here is the one person who wanted to simply hold up a thing saying, "But is it art?" But there are, you can find it on the website, there are hundreds more. So here you have some very modern ideas of art. First of all, art as something temporary, that's a very modern idea. You can't sell it. If it only lasts an hour, you can't sell it. So art as something temporary, this is a very modern sort of idea. Okay, so this is the Tate Gallery, and the fourth plinth are two of the big symbols of the appreciation of modern arts. Let's go back a bit and look at some of the most famous painters and sculptors since 1945. This gentleman began before 1945. In fact, he was born in 1898, But he continued until he died in 1986. Who has already heard of Henry Moore? Anybody already heard of Henry Moore? He is very popular in Germany and very popular in Italy. And France, that doesn't seem to be quite the... There are two Henry Moore statues in Paris, one of them in front of the United Nations. But in Germany, they're everywhere. Abstractions of the... Yeah? There's one of his statues is in front of the United Nations building, UNESCO building in Paris. Yeah. Do you know the UNESCO building?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's one of his in front of it, I promise you. What does he do? This is very typical Henry Moore. That is that they are human figures, but suggestive or abstract rather than developed. He did a long series of statues called Family. He was born in Yorkshire. His father was a mining engineer. He was from a family of 8 children, so a working class family. His parents wanted him to do something else and not be a miner. He says he decided to become a sculptor when he was 11, when he discovered Michelangelo. After the First World War, he became the first student of sculpture at the Leeds School of Art. Oh, sorry, there's some more. Very typical then, human figures but not realistic. Very often placed in parks or on hills, that he uses the place. Sometimes, of course, they're in town. And they can be more or less abstract. That one's in Leeds, I think, a little more abstract perhaps. Much more abstract. So the idea of playing with human forms and taking them down to a more abstract level. Yeah, this is that's obviously still a human being lying down, but put in different ways with the hope that the breaking up and the changing of the human form will communicate some emotion or attitude about the grandeur of human beings. That's the kind of idea. Yes, he got the commission for the UNESCO building in Paris in 1957. That shows something else about modern art. Unlike traditional art, very often the money which is necessary to be a sculptor or a painter can come from the public funds. Yes, in the 17th century, if you were an artist, you wanted to find a friendly prince or somebody to pay you. In the 20th century, well, UNESCO, governments, local governments, and so on. On the University of Chicago, there's another one, another, always very grand figures, quite powerful sorts of figures, not fragile as such. This is Henry Moore, more abstract Henry Moore in Cambridge there.
No artists have sponsors?
It's very difficult. You don't normally have individual sponsors. It can happen. It can happen, but it's pretty hard. Sometimes you have a company, Saatchi & Saatchi, a big company or a big bank or something. Even if you have a big bank like the Crédit Lyonnais and they're building a new building, they will ask some very famous sculptor to make a very nice sculpture in front. But they will have to leave him quite a lot of freedom. Yeah, it's not like in the 19th century where they would say to the sculptor, make a sculpture of our boss and make him look very pretty. That's traditional. Yeah? Whereas today, even an organization like Crédit Lyonnais, for example, wants to show how open and cultivated they are, and they do this by a symbol of modern art, and very often sculpture. This is the first one. This is not him, is it? Yeah. No. This is one of the first. Sorry. This is one of the first ones he did. Was very much inspired by Mexican traditional art. During the Second World War, he did a lot of drawing. He was an official war artist, and he drew a lot the people who were hiding in the underground, because hiding in the underground was a smart thing to do during the Second World War. There he is again, sleeping figures in the underground. There is a big sculpture park of Henry Moore up near Leeds. And it's just an enormous park, and it's a farm as well. There are sheep and everything. But there's also, every 100 yards or so, a sculpture. So it makes an amusing day out. The last example for Henry Moore, because I only have a few minutes for each artist, is this 12-foot-tall piece in the middle of a large open plaza at the University of Chicago. And this statue was unveiled exactly 25 years after the first nuclear reaction, the first artificial nuclear reaction, which was done by Mr. Fermi at the University of Chicago 25 years earlier. And so this is nuclear energy. Now, some people have been criticized by it. They say, oh, it looks like a mushroom cloud, a nuclear bomb, or it looks like a skull. In any case, they seem to be happy with it. Henry Moore was recognized eventually by the establishment, and in 1951, the Queen asked him to become a knight, Chevalier, but he refused. He refused because he said he didn't want to be, 1951, he didn't want to become an establishment figure. So you can see that although his work is not specially political, it's not political really, nevertheless he saw the artist as somebody outside the establishment, has to be independent, and so on. Sculptors probably in this period of the 50s, the 60s and the 70s, British sculpture was better known than British painting. Painting was more America, there was the powerful people in painting, and British sculpture had three or four people who were being quite effective. This lady was born in 1903, Barbara Hepworth. Alors, si vous n'avez pas entendu parler de Henry Moore, vous risquez pas d'avoir entendu parler de Barbara Hepworth. C'est normal, aussi on ne vous explique pas trop l'histoire de l'art britannique. C'est pour ça que je suis là, je suis payé pour, là, et très, pour ça, et très bien payé d'ailleurs. Okay, Barbara Hepworth. She was a friend of Henry Moore, and I'm only showing you these two, Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth, but there was also Ben Nicholson, Naum Gabo, and people like that. There were three or four, there's a little group of them who worked together, because you learn more things if you work together. She also came from the north of England, from Wakefield, near in Yorkshire, and today there is a Barbara Hepworth Museum, which is much smaller than the Henry Moore Museum, but there is a Barbara Hepworth Museum in Wakefield for people who like that sort of thing. She accepted the honours of the Queen, and she died before him. I think she died in when did she die? I just said it. 75. She died in 75. That's a Barbara Hepworth playing with forms. Yes, she doesn't really do people. She continues onto the forms, and also very much. This is called Homage to Mondrian. Donc c'est un hommage au peintre. Kind of crucifixion as well. She liked to do these forms where, as you walk around them, they change. They change a lot as you walk around them. This is a so abstract sculpture, but the sort of thing that people like to have in a public park or so on. This is because ideas have changed. Of course, 100 years ago, what did you want in a public park? A statue of the famous people of the town, the mayor of the town and the person who founded the bank. This is the 19th century sculptures. And late 20th century sculptures are more abstract. Go on, please. There you go. More. Barbara Hepworth still. Barbara Hepworth again. And that's all I have about Barbara Hepworth. It's a pity because another thing which she does a lot of inside is wooden sculptures with strings, with a lot of strings, avec beaucoup de cordes. It's something she's well known for. Okay. Let's move to a painter. L.S. Lowry, again from the north of England, maybe I'm being biased towards the north of England, lived in Stretford near Manchester. And for a long time, he painted and was not recognized by anybody. He was not famous at all. He didn't sell any paintings for 30, 40 years. And he specialized in... Well, that's a picture. That's where he lived. He specialized in the urban landscape. That is to say, he liked to paint pictures of the town he lived in, and in particular with people in them. At the time, this was very strange. Everybody was busy painting the sea and the countryside in Holland and the sea in the south of France and nature. And nobody was interested in ordinary people's houses and ordinary people's workplace. And in this case, they are going to the football match. This is the football match. They're all going to the football match. They're not looking... they're looking like life is quite hard. Yeah. They don't have a lot of personality. So it's a reflection on the joys and difficulties of life with little half-dead dogs. And so on. Yes? Sorry, say that again? Manchester. Yeah, Manchester. Yeah. Or in fact, Stretford, which is the suburbs of Manchester. Amusements. One of the strange things about Lowry is, as I said, he painted ordinary people for a long time and eventually was recognised. I think he's the only artist who had a pop song written for him. When he died, some pop singer wrote a song for him. Not necessarily a very good song, but most painters, you don't get a pop song written after you. But it was number one. It was a very, very popular pop song written about an artist. Now the only thing that's left now is that nobody has ever written a pop song about a university teacher. So I'm just waiting. I may be next or not. Yeah, or not. There you go. You can see that they're not in. He's not showing people in an idealized manner. Yeah. And yet, I think it's also he's not being negative about people as such either. He managed to get some training in an art school, and worked all his life. In a property company, going round to people's houses saying, "Oh, it's time for the rent, please, can you give me the rent?" He had an ordinary office job his whole life through. And so he became extremely famous, but eventually made some money. But not that much, really, because when he died, he was worth £300,000, which for a world-famous artist is not a lot of money. It's more than I've got. There you go. I saw all the smoke out of the factory chimneys and so on. The life dominated by the factories. And this is a memorial statue to him when he died. And you can see that this is a contemporary statue because it's sitting down on a bench, which traditional statues are on a plinth, very high ground, yeah, very ordinary. And there he is sitting, painting a memorial statue to Lowry. Move on to another one, Francis Bacon. So certainly Lowry is very much British, but perhaps some of the others, really, they happen to be British and really they're part of an international modern art phenomenon. Francis Bacon, born in Ireland, in fact, but to English painters, and works very much on the human figure, generally rather distorted and painful. Yeah. You see the mouth in the middle there. He looks in a bad way. Yes, yeah. He looks like that. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. This is a modern version of a traditional painting by Velázquez of a Pope Innocent, and so it's a new version. But he's being destroyed and screaming. Oh, that's the traditional, that's the original by Velázquez. And this is La Reprise de Bacon. This is where you see something which is very important about modern art, is that very often traditional art has the idea we want to show beauty, we want to communicate beauty, and one section of modern art has said, well, that's been done. It's okay to communicate beauty, but that's been done for hundreds of years. Let's do something different. And this is obviously not intended to communicate beauty. It's about communicating anxiety, fear. This is a triptych, which is normally a religious form, like, you know, the crucifixion and so on. So the idea is to communicate negative feelings, fear and disgust and terror. And those sorts of things. He had a pretty hard life. In particular, his partner died, and he became extremely depressed. Also, he lived in the well. He lived until I can't find his date anymore. Anyway. Yes, that's right. In the 50s and 60s, when he was painting, he was homosexual, and it was a very difficult time to be that at the time. And he certainly has a pretty hard time. Okay. Moving right on, Lucian Freud. There was an exhibition of Lucian Freud's in Paris last year. He is, in fact, the granddaughter of... Sorry, the grandson of Sigmund Freud. If your grandfather is Sigmund Freud, he's born in 1922. He's not dead yet. Yeah, that's right. He's not dead yet. Yes. Yeah, okay, that's why. And perhaps more traditional type of figure. Rather on the expressionist side. This is the sort of thing he goes in for. So trying to express. No doubt the memories and sensuality. He spent a lot of time, apparently, in the 1970s, he spent 4,000 hours on a series of paintings of his mother. But he also very frequently painted animals. He liked to paint animals. Lucian Freud. There's the animal, the dog. I think that's probably not his mother now, because she's too young. Yeah, she's too young at the time. Yeah. There's the dog again. He likes the dogs. Another dog. Portraits with dogs. Okay, again, he's not looking for a perfect top model people to paint. He's looking for ordinary people. Thin, fat, strange shapes. And no doubt his most famous painting. This is his most famous painting, which obviously is Queen Elizabeth. See you next time. Which obviously is Queen Elizabeth II. She asked him to paint it, and she sat for it. Was she happy with the result? Yeah. We don't know if she was happy with the result, is the answer. Say again. That's right. She's not absolutely stupid. This is Lucian Freud, you know. She could have asked somebody who was going to do a traditional beautiful painting. Yes, she's not stupid. Yeah. We don't know if she. Certainly, the conservative newspapers were horrified. Huh? There was a big campaign against, oh, this disgusting, terrible. I don't think it's a hostile portrait. It's obviously, for a royal portrait, it's very original. Because we have seen so many portraits of kings and queens, you know. If there's a royal painter, it's very original. So, the queen. According to The Sun, that the conservative newspaper, this makes her look like one of the royal corgis who has suffered a stroke. Selon The Sun, ça lui fait ressembler à un de ces petits chiens qui a eu un AVC. Okay, so they weren't too happy with it. So look at Martin Parr. We're moving into another generation now, born in 1952. And like most of these 20th century artists, they go to art school, which is, you know, of course, in the previously was less organized. And Martin Parr is a photographer. And he simply takes photographs. He doesn't paint, he takes photographs. And in particular, he takes photographs of people on holiday. And particular English food. Or maybe it's not English, actually, because there's all the foreign language underneath it. But certainly likes to do particular colours. Would you like to eat this? Yeah, I thought it was quite good. Yeah, I was brought up on this stuff. Okay. More photographs of people serving in restaurants. Life looking rather hard, yeah? Life looking rather hard, but on holiday. Where are they? A swimming pool. It's not the sea. It's a picture of the sea behind. Yeah. And so there's obviously something social about his photography. There's a sort of comment. Not a precise comment, because people don't want precise comments on, you know, people don't want to be told what to think, but it's supposed to help you think about people having fun. And yeah, they're actually in a swimming pool, and at the back end there is a painting of the sky. So it's a kind of cheap way of going on holiday. That's a photograph of a car factory. As well as photography, he was also a collector of postcards. And he published a book called Boring Postcards, Des cartes postales ennuyeuses. And he collected for 20 years the most incredible postcards. For example, this one, which is the first motorway which was built in Britain. And it's a postcard because at the time it felt so wonderful that we have a motorway. But today we look at it and, yeah, it's not quite got that, it doesn't quite excite us in the same way. The collection, Boring Postcards, so very interesting. It's a reflection on pictures, and it's a reflection on society, and it's a reflection on how we react to it. There's quite a lot behind there if you're prepared to spend a bit of time in it. This is a boring postcard of a nuclear reactor, une centrale nucléaire. Okay, so you wish you were here. This is my favourite one. This is c'est un village de vacances, hein. C'est le petit appart studio de vacances, hein, au bord de la mer. Hein. And there you have the picture of the table and the chairs as a postcard. It's not a photograph as such. Well, it is a photograph, but it's as a postcard. So it obviously says something about that, you know, people thought this was wonderful at the time. Whereas, you know, I mean, it's all right, but, you know, it's not so exciting. We're more difficult these days, I think. Here you can see the British being determined to sit on the beach, even though it's obviously raining or cold or both. So it's just, you know, a great determination of British people. But really, their brother-in-law has gone to Spain and they're jealous. You know, it's pretty rough stuff. This is Martin Parr again. Martin Parr. Going to continue with three or four more controversial artists. Tracy Amin, then, who is nearly as old as me, born in 1963. And herself and a series of other artists came to be known as the YBA group, the Young British Artists, about 10 or 15 years ago. So obviously somebody thought that there was something British about them and that they were a group. She works on all sorts of stuff, and sometimes it's very controversial. This is an early painting about friendship. but she's famous for, not your favourite, she's famous for more controversial stuff. For example, this work in 1995 is called Everyone I Have Ever Slept With, and it's a tent, and inside there is embroidered the name of everybody who she has slept with, including friends or brothers and sisters who slept in the same bed when she was a child, right up to her lovers when she was older. Yes. And so here are all her boyfriends and friends and so on. And at the bottom, with myself or with myself. So what have we got here? I think we've got a lot of play going on because... like the form is very homely, yeah, embroidery, and yet the you would expect this form to say something like, you know, with best wishes on your birthday, and something not so controversial and personal. And indeed, Tracy Emin is known for being very personal in her art and putting her personal life out there. Here is another example. This is embroidery. Now, traditionally, embroidery is for traditional women, sit at home and embroider when you're an old lady or something. But the message is not at all traditional. I do not expect to be a mother, but I do expect to die alone. That's very aggressive, punk message. But the form is embroidery, which is very, you know, again, it should be home sweet home, or you only have one mother, so look after her. It's the kind of very traditional message. And so she's playing with the traditional form and the very modern message. My brain's all split up. She went out like a 40 what bulb? I want it back, that girl of 17. Yeah, so at the bottom it says, I want it back, that girl of 17. Yeah, I'm getting old. And this is the most famous of her works. And the most controversial one, it's called My Bed, and it's a bed with clothes and dirty clothes and used condoms and things like that. So again, the idea is to play with the reaction you can make, which may be a reaction of shock or disgust, and not about a reaction of beauty. This is the one that obviously shocked people most. It was bought for a lot of money by a National Gallery. She also does work with neon. Of course, neon traditionally says Coca-Cola or some advertising thing. And so the contrast between the traditional use of neon and this, only God knows I'm good, is not the kind of message you expect to see in neon. This is a play going on. Yeah, this is you should have loved me. Tu aurais dû m'aimer. Okay, in neon. Yeah. Why not? And that's the final one. They're just in the very corner of the plinth. Yeah, use of plinth. Yeah, meerkat.com. Yeah, it's a fait. Comme la publicité là. Also a member of the young British artist Damien Hirst, born in 1965, and similarly controversial, here he is with two of his works. One of the most famous ones here. Yeah, do you recognize the person on the left is Mickey Mouse, mm-hmm. and the person on the right is Ronald McDonald, and who's in the middle?
A little girl from a famous picture of the Vietnam War, and she's running because her clothes are burnt, and
Napalm. That's right, a victim of American bombing in Vietnam. So obviously here we have she's just burning and taking a very horrible picture. Yeah. So obviously more a political thing here, where you have Mickey Mouse and Ronald McDonald, who are carrying this girl who is the symbol, the most famous photographic symbol of war atrocities, the most famous one. There are one or two others, but yes. So. Sometimes he does political stuff like that, but not always. Here's just something more pulling you to pieces. He does a lot of work about death. And indeed, he was lucky because he got a... he got a sponsor, David Saatchi, Charles Saatchi, who is very, very rich, said, "I will pay you to do any work you want." And so he was very lucky; he could do what he wanted. Certainly wanted to work a lot with Shock. He once produced a work which was called "Two Fucking and Two Watching," and which was a cow and a bull rotting. Donc une vache et un taureau. Des cadavres pourrissants. And the New York government banned it because of fears of vomiting among visitors. So he managed to get himself banned in that way. He just generally would do quite a lot of disgusting ones. He has very often disgusting stuff. This is not so disgusting. He likes to work on death, but this one is not so disgusting. It looks very simple. It's a skull. The skull is made of platinum, and it is covered with diamonds. And it cost £20 million to make. So, obviously, here, something that which I think is not too difficult to understand is the idea of death. And money, and however rich you are, you still end up this way. But extremely expensive, £20 million. £20 million to make, and it was to be sold for. He tried to sell it for €75 million, but it wasn't possible. They didn't manage to sell it, and so it was finally bought by a group of people, including himself. And so people bought the right to show it for a month every year or something. But again, this is very much conceptual art, really. It's the idea that that you can spend so much money on representing death in public. So these are the kind of things going on. The physical possibility of death in the mind of someone living. This is a shark preserved in liquid. Things like that. It's a shark, say a hooker.
A real one?
A real dead one. Yeah, a real dead one preserved in formaldehyde. Okay, so we can see there's quite a wide number of themes, but also a quite wide number of ways of getting people thinking about representing the world. We have just two more, I think. No, we have three more. Andy Goldsworthy, born 1956. And this is his most famous work. It's called Arch. And what it is it's an arch made of stones, but every night he moves it somewhere else. He did it for a few months. Every night he moved it somewhere else. He left it there for a day, and then he moved it and put it somewhere else. And he did this for a few months along a path which was the traditional path for people to bring animals down hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So, I mean, the arch has always been a symbol of victory or something like that. And so it's a link with history, and it's a mobile piece of art. There it is, arch. There it is again. And he wrote a book about what people said to him when he was doing it. Yeah, so it becomes an experience as a thing. That's another one of his. That's another one of his. Different one. Next generation, again, born in 1974. Just a little child, really. Born in 1974. Getting close to you. Is Banksy. Have you heard of Banksy? Yes, you heard of him. Yeah? Absolutely, yeah. Graffiti guy. And he would do stuff like this. Yeah. So why graffiti? Well, also, Banksy is not his real name. He is anonymous, and he insists on remaining anonymous. He doesn't want to be known. This means he can't really make much money. So this is, in some ways, a protest against art becoming big money and so on. So he would go for graffiti. Take the photograph. And then, of course, quite often it would disappear because people would move it. Sometimes it's just humorous. There's a dead phone box. A lot of humour involved. There are a few other artists around him, but I haven't time to look at them.
But there was a film made about...
There was indeed a film made for him. Was it Turn Exit Through the Gift Shop? La sortie, c'est à travers la boutique à souvenirs. Again, it's the idea of art shouldn't be about money too much. Ça, c'était quelque chose qui était déjà là, et lui, il a simplement rajouté, this looks a bit like an elephant. Yeah. OK. Mark Wallinger, c'est aussi d'aujourd'hui, mais je n'ai plus la date. And he did a political work called State Britain, which I'm going to explain to you, State Britain. Opposite the Parliament in Britain, for a long time during the Iraq War, there was a peace camp by a political man who was a little bit mad, but very political, and this was there. And they didn't manage to move it. Ils n'arrivaient pas à trouver la loi qui permettait la police de le virer. Parce que ce n'est pas illégal, il avait trouvé un moyen de le faire, ce n'est pas illégal. Alors la police ne pouvait pas le virer. But they were very angry because it was opposite the Parliament. All the tourists who came to London saw this, which said, you know, how many people have died in Iraq of a political anti-war movement. And the government then passed a special law saying that it is illegal to have political demonstrations less than 1 mile from the Parliament. They passed a new law specially for this reason. It was not too successful because they didn't write the law correctly and they lost. But at this time, 1 mile from the Houses of Parliament went exactly down the middle of Tate Modern, the modern art gallery. And so Mark Wallinger, the artist, made an exact reproduction of this in the middle of the art gallery, so that half of it was legal, because it was more than a mile from the Parliament, and half of it was illegal, because it was less than a mile. And he reproduced it exactly. It's all copied exactly from photographs. Find the exact same teddy bear and so on. You know, murdered children, baby killers, etc. So it was the artist's protest because the peace camp was moved. And it was also a game about, well... I'm less than a mile from the Parliament. Why don't you come and arrest me? Which, of course, was politically impossible, because if you send the police into an art gallery, it doesn't look too good. So this is State Britain. And here, this is exactly what he reproduced. It's the reproduction again. That's another one by the same guy. This is Mark Wallinger again. Bill Woodrow. We saw him earlier on. He also does this thing, look, the washing machine. Or is that a washing machine or a sink? A household appliance made into a musical instrument. Again, it's playing with ideas. And Anthony Caro, who went for more abstract structures. Yeah, more abstract structures. There. The steps there. And the very last one, Anthony Gormley. Anthony Gormley produced this, the Angel of the North, which is enormous and has become the symbol of the northeast of England. They wanted, you know, like Rio de Janeiro and everywhere else, a symbolic thing. That's Mark Wallinger. That's also Mark Wallinger, public statues. And that was an extremely fast introduction, 1 hour and 5 minutes introduction to British art since 1945. But I think it's good to sort of see what's going on in a different area like that. Questions?